Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at will.uiuc.edu.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. It is a lovely, lovely Sunday, April 23rd, 2006. We're coming to you live. Our guest today is someone who's been on the show in the past. He's been much requested by listeners over the past year or two. He is Howard Zinn, the historian and political scientist. Since the 1960s, Howard Zinn has been an important figure in the civil rights and anti-war movements in the United States. He's the author of 20 books, including, most famously, A People's History of the United States. He's a professor emeritus in political science and history at Boston University, winner of numerous awards, including the Thomas Merton Award and the Eugene V. Debs Award. And he lives currently in Newton, Massachusetts. Howard Zinn's autobiography is You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train. I could go on and on just talking about Howard Zinn's writings and his accomplishments, but I'd rather talk to Howard Zinn. Howard Zinn, welcome to Media Matters.
Oh, thank you, Bob. Glad to be talking with you.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here, and I think I'd like to start to take advantage of your historical perspective on the current situation. And maybe what, in your sense, the invasion and occupation of Iraq, where does this historically, how do you think this is going to be appraised down the road in terms of where it stands in American history?
Well, you know, while we at this moment see it, many people see it as sort of a unique event, it is really part of a long history. And I think in perspective years from now, people will see the invasion of Iraq as simply the latest in a long series of aggressive militaristic acts in American foreign policy. It's a history of American expansion, which starts, in fact, it starts right after the revolution. It starts with moving west. It starts with all the forays into the western territories, into the in the 19th century, the driving out of Indian tribes, the annihilation, the massacre of Indians, the taking of half of Mexico in the Mexican War, all that happening in the 19th century, and then at the very turn of the century, moving into Cuba, and then into the Philippines, and a very long and bloody war in the Philippines. And then all sorts of forays into Central America, at least 20 interventions in Central America in the early part of the century. And, well, we know more about the recent history, but it's, and since World War II, war after war in Korea, Vietnam, going into Cambodia and Laos, and then Panama, Grenada, and now a second war in Iraq, and in the midst of it, a war on Afghanistan. My point is that what we are seeing now, while it is a particularly deceptive kind of situation, the war has always been accompanied by deception and lies coming from Washington and various excuses and rationales and justifications given for our aggressive wars. After all, we haven't been defending ourselves, not since the War of 1812. We haven't been defending ourselves. The Department of Defense is very much misnamed. We have been the aggressor for a very, very long period of time, and all of it justified by the idea that we are bringing liberty and democracy or civilization and Christianity and to these various countries. But in fact, of course, we have not done that. We have mostly brought tyranny and military dictators into power, and we have often overthrown democratic governments in order to establish right-wing militarist governments. So, yes, it's a long history of which this war on Iraq is the latest event, which I suppose means that we are dealing not just with this war, we're dealing with something deep-rooted in the American system.
Howard Zinn, the war right now, the occupation, looks like little short of an unmitigated disaster. from the perspective of the United States policymakers, elites, the people who run the government and the country. Do you think this is going to put a damper on future such invasions and occupations, if not just because it's looked like tactically or strategically wrong, but just because they won't have the resources to do it? What will be the implications for the next 5, 10, 15 years of the Iraq occupation and the disaster of it?
Well, I'm hopeful that we won't see a repeat of what we have seen since the Vietnam War. Now, of course, that is... After the Vietnam War, the administration went to great lengths to do away with what they called the Vietnam syndrome, or syndrome meaning a kind of sickness. What was sick to them about the Vietnam War is that a great anti-war movement developed, and the United States had to withdraw from Vietnam. And then they set about very deliberately to overcome this by engaging in small, quick wars, not giving the anti-war movement time to develop. And what I'm hoping is that they will not succeed in doing this again, that I'm hoping that this experience in Iraq, this, as you said, it's an unmitigated disaster. I'm hoping that this disastrous situation in Iraq, a war which has not the slightest of credibility in terms of morality, hoping that this war in Iraq will turn the American people away, not just from this war, but from future wars, so that if the United States attempts to go to war against Iran, my feeling is that the American people are sick of this war in Iraq. In fact, the public opinion polls show that. Public opinion polls show 60 to 70% of the American people opposed to the war, wanting us to get out of Iraq sooner or later. My hope is that this feeling against the war in Iraq will remain, that it won't be quickly turned and forgotten, and this is my best hope, that the American people will decide, as a result of this experience, and maybe thinking back to Vietnam, maybe decide as a result of this experience that war itself cannot be tolerated anymore, that it's not just this war or that war, but that war itself in our time is an abomination. That it is, whatever the excuses, whatever the reasons, whoever the tyrant is that we are presumably overthrowing, whatever the words that are thrown out to persuade the American people to go into it, you know, that war, because it inevitably, with the technology of modern warfare, war is the inevitable killing, mass killing of innocent people, because of that war simply cannot be accepted as a way of dealing with whatever exists in the world, whether it's tyranny or aggression or whatever it is, war is not the way.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Howard Zinn, the historian and political scientist, author of 20 books at least, including A People's History of the United States. Howard Zinn is joining us from his home in Newton, Massachusetts. My name is Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Howard Zinn, our phone number here at WILL AM 580 is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Howard Zinn, in the current issue of Rolling Stone magazine, the Princeton historian Sean Wilentz has the cover story in which I think he makes the argument that George W. Bush will go down as the worst president in American history. I don't know if you've seen the article yet, but I'd be interested in your assessment of that claim and of George W. Bush as president.
Well, I haven't read the article, but it immediately strikes me as absolutely right. Now, of course, to call Bush the worst president in American history is to say that after there's a lot of competition, we have had a lot of really bad presidents. You know, when people sometimes ask me, because I've been so critical of the American government, they say, well, please, can you t- tell us the name of a good president?
Mm-hmm.
I have to think hard and, you know, come up with maybe one name, you see.
Yeah, who do you come up with, by the way?
Well, I come up with, after saying that, you know, there's been no president that has really solved fundamental problems that this country has. No president willing to fundamentally alter the evils of the capitalist system, for instance. But the one president who sort of began to move in that direction, and he did that in the context of economic crisis and turmoil over the country, was FDR.
Mm-hmm.
That was the one moment in American history when a president, and I don't want to diminish FDR's own humanitarian feelings, although they weren't total, and very often when he was feeling most generous towards the poor people or black people, it was because Eleanor Roosevelt was at his side pushing him on. But still, Roosevelt reacted to what was going on in the country, and as a result, in the 1930s, we have the kinds of things that are gradually being eroded today. That is, we had federal employment, that is, government giving jobs to people, millions of jobs that private enterprise could not do. The Social Security, unemployment insured, subsidized housing, all these things that are under attack. So that was one moment in American history when we can say a president was sensitive to what was going on in the country. Bush is totally insensitive. I mean, here we have the majority of the country now opposed to the war, and Bush, you know, plows on. Do you remember during the Vietnam War, there was a song sung about Lyndon Johnson, waist-deep in the Big Muddy.
Yeah, Pete Seeger.
Pete Seeger sang it. Waist-deep in the Big Muddy, and the big fool says, push on. And I think he was led to that. Of course, he was talking about the war in Vietnam, but I think what prompted it was the fact that there was a story in the papers about how these Marines were on maneuver, they're practicing, and they were going through this swamp, and they were sinking in this mire, sinking, and they recognized that, you know, somebody might die, but their officer said, no, you've got to push on, and somebody did die. And that's the situation we're in. Bush is waist-deep in the Big Muddy, and he and Rumsfeld and Cheney and Condoleezza Rice all saying, push on. So, yes, it's fair to say he is the worst, and therefore it is time to talk about removing him from office. Impeachment, yes. I was in Wisconsin this past week, and I guess not far from where you are.
That's and, right, just north of us.
That's right. And there were, oh, I don't know, you know, how many people were there, a huge number of people were there, 1,000 people or so, and somebody asked me, what do you think of Russ Feingold's call for censure of Bush? And I said, well, what's most troubling about it is the cowardice of the Democratic Party in not going along with him, in fact, distancing themselves from him. And after all, censure is a rather mild form of rebuke, and what we really need is to impeach Bush. And I got the biggest round of applause that I'd gotten all evening. In other words, I believe, and the public opinion polls show this, there are a large number of Americans who are ready to call for impeachment. They are way ahead, as they usually are, of the members of Congress.
Yeah, it's funny. You mentioned impeachment compared to when President Bill Clinton was impeached and then went later to a vote on the floor of the Senate for whether it should be removed office.
Mm.
You know, the press coverage of Bush's, you know, impeachable crimes barely exists compared to the extensive and detailed coverage of Bill Clinton's relationships with Monica Lewinsky.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I spoke of the cowardice of the Democratic Party. I could also speak of the cowardice of the press. by the major media, because the lies of the Bush administration and the crimes of the Bush administration, I mean, crimes, they are war crimes. It is a crime, and this was defined in the Nuremberg trials at the end of World War II. It is a war crime to carry on an aggressive war against a nation that has not attacked you, and which is what they convicted the Nazi leaders for. And this is a talk about the requirement in the Constitution for impeachment, high crimes and misdemeanor. What could be a higher crime than waging an aggressive war against another country, invading another country with the result of thousands of Americans and tens of thousands of people in another country dying as a result? And yet the major media have been so reluctant to talk about removing Bush from office. And what they do play up very often is the most superficial criticism of the war, like the generals who have come out for the removal of Rumsfeld. Well, you know, you remove one rotten apple from a barrel full of rotten apples, and what are these generals mostly calling for? Say, well, you know, Rumsfeld didn't follow our tactical plan. We wanted more troops. Well, those are superficial issues. Removing this guy or that person, sending more or less troops. No, the crucial issue is we don't belong there. My friend Anthony Arnov has written a book called Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal. And in it, he very, very very carefully and systematically goes through all the arguments for staying in Iraq and really puts all of them down and makes a very convincing case that we should get out of Iraq as fast as we possibly can.
Our guest today in Media Matters is Howard Zinn, the historian and political scientist, professor emeritus at Boston University, author, among other things, of A People's History of the United States, one of the most famous scholarly books, popular scholarly books of the past 50 years. This is a live show coming to you today on WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. You can call in to speak with Howard Zinn at 333-9455, our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. 1 week from today on Media Matters, our guest will be Janine Jackson from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, so please tune in 167 hours. But in the meantime, let's go back to the phone lines, or to the phone lines for the first time. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air with Howard Zinn.
Yes, it's a tremendous honor to speak to you, sir. I've respected and read your work for a long time, and I just wanted to raise a couple of questions and one small comment. I just recall, I think it was in your book and then in a series of other books, about Lincoln's denunciation of the Mexican War in the Spot Amendments and so on. I wish you'd just talk a little bit about that, because I think our listeners probably don't know much about that, and I think it's a very interesting position that he took at the time. Another thing is about the Imperium, the American Imperium that Chalmers Johnson and others have written about. I've heard that there are some, 13 to 14 bases that the Americans are trying to construct in Iraq, and as you noted historically, this all fits in with the building of the American Manifest Destiny, or its imperium by extension. And I'm wondering how you think this might be related to not simply the United States, but just the tendencies of the nation-state system as we know it. In other words, if China becomes powerful, it will probably do the same thing as the United States. This is, again, not to excuse the United States. Our imperium is quite incomparable historically, but that it's related to the nature of the nation-state. And I'm a scholar of Japan, and I even see the Japanese and, of course, Europe and elsewhere, that the rising tide of nationalism is very strong in our era, every era, but it seems to be that the nation-state is alive and well in spite of what many post-structuralists and others tell us.
Well, those are really important questions. And let me first comment on what you were saying about Lincoln and the Mexican War and the Spot Resolutions. And yes, Lincoln as a congressman asked the president, President Polk, who's saying, well, we're, you know, making war on Mexico because the Mexican troops have fired on American troops and blood has been shed on American soil. And actually, of course, it wasn't American soil. And it was disputed territory. And it was just an excuse to go into Mexico and end up taking 40% of Mexican territory. And so Lincoln was asking, where is the spot where this supposed incident took place? It's as if somebody got up in Congress at the time of the Gulf of Tonkin, which of course Congress did not do, and ask, where is the damage done by these so-called PT boats, which are supposedly fired on destroyers? Is there any debris around? Is there any sign of anything being fired? Those would have been comparable to Lincoln's spot resolutions. So at that moment, you know, Lincoln was doing something very good in anti-war, although I must say that when it came to then to appropriating money for the war, Lincoln did vote for the appropriations, which is what a lot of sort of mildly anti-expansionist congressmen do again and again, and this was done during the Vietnam War, that is, they'll criticize the war, and then they'll vote to give money for the war. But let me go on to the bases in Iraq, and I agree with you very much about how it's not just the United States, it's the nation-state system, that is, and nationalism. And, of course, the United States isn't the first imperial power. It is, in fact, you might say, the last imperial power. At least I hope it will be the last imperial power. It's time we did away with imperial powers. But, yes, there's the nation-state system, this dividing of the world into these sort of fenced-in areas with dividing one another by passports and visas and flags and anthems, is a system that lends itself to war and to the greatest powers establishing bases everywhere, as the English did in India and in Africa and you know, and the Russians did most recently in Eastern Europe. It's just that the United States is the latest and you might say, has outdone all the others, being the unchallenged number one military power and establishing bases not only in Iraq, but in 100 other places in the world. So I agree that we ought to think not just of the United States and its bases in Iraq. We ought to think beyond that. We ought to think about nationalism and think about the fact that while the corporations may talk happily about globalization because they want capital to be able to flow easily from one place to another without national barriers, what we need to do is eliminate national barriers and move against the idea that people on one side of a boundary need to fight against people on another side of the boundary, you need to expand into another territory. If we need to have true globalization, globalization of human beings, not just a globalization of capital, and a world where we have eliminated national boundaries and nationalism and all the trappings of super jingoistic patriotism and, you know, we're better than you are, we're superior than you are. It's a disease which has affected all imperial powers in history, and is now, unfortunately, infecting too many people in the United States.
Howard Zinn, you referred to the bases, and the caller talked about Chalmers Johnson. Johnson has been a guest on this program a couple times, and the point he made on air with us was that our commitment to the military-industrial complex and to this vast network of bases has grown to the point where it's almost entirely unaccountable to Congress, not to mention to the American people. And it's almost removed entirely from any sort of popular control as envisioned by the Constitution. And he paints a picture almost of a situation where we no longer have popular rule in this country over our military, that it sort of stands outside the government in a way.
Well, it's a grim picture, and I think, you know, he's largely right. I say largely because I want to leave a little room for something else, and that is for opposition to what is going on and the possibility of opposition, even though, as he says, this military-industrial complex is so powerful. It operates outside of Congress and outside of popular control. Well, corporations have always operated outside of popular control, that corporations have done what they wanted to do. The only time corporations have been subject to any kind of popular control is when working people in these corporations have gone on strike or they've boycotted the corporations. In other words, despite the overwhelming power of the military-industrial complex, there is an economic power that ordinary people have, which at certain times is exercised in history as the farm workers exercise their power of boycott to bring in, rein in the power of the great growers out in California. And as in the 1930s, the working people in the steel and auto and rubber industries, by going on strike, even sit-down strikes, managed to actually limit the power of the great corporations over them. So I don't want to accept the fact that we don't have any power, except that it takes an awful lot of mobilization and commitment and agitation and organization to create this power over the military-industrial complex. And, I mean, Congress could do things if it wanted to. It could tax the big corporations in a very heavy way and diminish their enormous profits. It could regulate corporations and move away from the deregulation that we've had through a number of presidents, by the way, Democratic and Republican. But all that will require a popular movement, which combines the strength of all the movements we've seen in recent years, the strength of the black movement, the Latino movement, the women's movement, the anti-war movement, the environmental movement. It will require a new social movement which recognizes that only the unity of all of these people in these movements and their willingness to engage in the direct action of strikes and boycotts and civil disobedience, only that has a chance of diminishing and maybe even overcoming the power of the military-industrial complex.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Howard Zinn, the historian and political scientist, author of 20-some books, including A People's History of the United States. My name's Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters here in WILL AM 580. Our phone number, 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 1, Champagne, you're on the air with Howard Zinn.
Hi. I just want to say that using your book along with James Lowen's Lies My Teacher Told Me made for a very rewarding experience teaching seventh grade. But I particularly liked how you always had a message that this was a terrible history but not a reason to despair and to encourage young people to be active in political affairs. And certainly your schedule of touring the country is also testimony to that. So I'll just take my comments offline. Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I mean, that's my hope, of course, that teachers will teach history and teach about American society in a way that reflects independent thought and critical thought. And after all, what are we trying to do? We're trying to raise a new generation of people, of young people who, even while they're young, but certainly when they grow up, will challenge war and racial justice and economic injustice.
Okay, let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 2, Champaign County, you're on the air with Howard Zinn.
Good afternoon. The mention of Lincoln's sort of, I guess it's anti-imperialism, I don't know if there are other impulses for him opposing the Mexican War, reminded me that I don't know what you have to say about the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, the settlement of the Mexican War, which my understanding of it is it allowed for... It acknowledged the cultural necessity of transit across the border in some regard or another. And I don't know how you, it seems like it fits in with the Trail of Broken Treaties of all the Indian wars. But I really wanted to ask you about a couple of times you were on, I think it was on this show, and a gentleman from out in the boonies was from the World War II generation and referred to you as Bombardier Zinn. I don't know if you remember that. Mm. But I wanted you to ask you to talk about this fixation on the tactical nuclear weapon in Iran. I went to the Union of Concerned Scientists website, and they have one of these little flash animations showing what the best possible result of a use of that would be. And they claim that the Pentagon's own analysis would suggest that the nuclear plume would go all the way across to India, and that perhaps as many as hundreds of thousands of people would actually would die from the radiation, and many would be affected by it. And just it is daunting. It is good to hear you for hopes up, but I'll sign off and let someone else ring in. Thank you.
Okay, Howard Zinn.
Well, you know, we're dealing with madness. I mean, that is when dealing with the idea of using nuclear weapons. I mean, this is insanity. After all, we are the only country that ever dropped nuclear weapons on any other people, which we did at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And here's the most powerful country in the world talking about tactical nuclear weapons, which the idea of the word tactical means that they're smaller nuclear weapons. And instead of killing 100 million people, they'll only kill 10 million people. I mean, what it suggests to us is that we need to speed up our efforts to take away power from the people in Washington who have their hands on the button, who are making these decisions, and who are capable of anything. I mean, these people are ruthless. And if they were capable of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, if they were capable of killing several million people in Vietnam, if they're capable of killing 50 to 100,000 people in Iraq, then, yes, they're capable of using nuclear weapons and trying to find some excuse for using it. And, of course, Iran, it's interesting about Iran that they want to use Iran as an excuse to use tactical nuclear weapons, presumably to prevent Iran from getting nuclear weapons. Now, if you look down in the bottom paragraphs of the stories of the past few months about Iran, you will find that the people who know something about nuclear weapons will say, and they've said it a number of times, Iran is at least 5 to 10 years away from having any nuclear weapon. And even that number of years is contingent on a number of technical requirements, which it's not at all clear Iran can meet. So that they are building up hysteria about Iran's nuclear weapons when Iran might have a nuclear weapon in 5 or 10 years, and the United States is in possession of 10,000 nuclear weapons. And this is madness.
Howard Zinn, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have a couple of callers patiently waiting, but I just want to change the topic for 1 second,
okay,
if we can. Howard, you're also a playwright. You wrote the play Marx in Soho, which I had the privilege of watching. You know, how important is Marx, and how important is the notion of class and class struggle to contemporary politics, or are these really just sort of out-of-date, you know, philosophies and terms?
Well, I mean, to me, the important thing about Marx, and Marx, of course, was not right about everything. He thought capitalism would fall much, much sooner than obviously it has, and he may have been wrong also about the idea of a dictatorship of the proletariat, which he thought would by its in nature wither away, and we saw the dictatorship in the Soviet Union did not wither away. But on the other hand, Marx had a number of very important insights, and one of them is about the class character of politics and of the systems of modern times. And this is something that's very much lacking in our histories here in the United States and in our political science courses in the United States. That is, their failure to recognize what Marx recognizes, that behind political issues are economic issues, behind political issues are class issues, that the nation is not one indivisible nation with common interest, but the nation consists of people with very different interests. And interestingly enough, Madison, James Madison, founding father, really understood this, and this was long before Marx was born, and he wrote in Federalist Number 10 about how the fact that society is divided into people with property and people without property. And so Madison accepted that as a sort of basic fact about society, but it has been forgotten, and it's been plastered over by this notion of, well, there's something called the national interest or something like national security, as if they're different, not different interests, different definitions of security. But, you know, all you have to do is look at the United States today, even though we try to avoid the notion of class conflict. I mean, what do we have in the United States today? We have 1% of the population, the richest 1% of the population, owning 43% of the wealth. We have hugely wealthy CEOs on the one hand. We have people struggling, having to have two jobs, and in order to just barely keep their families alive. So we are living in a class society, and it's very important to recognize that, and to recognize that the people in the government belong to a different class than we do. The people in the government have different interests than we do. Because if you think that the government has the same interests that we do, then, oh, well, you will think the government will only do things if it's in the national interest, if it's in the interest of everybody in the country. No, the government will do things that are in the interest of one class, and that is the wealthy, powerful class. And once you recognize that the government and the corporations have different interests than most of the American people, you will have a much more acute insight into why certain policies take place, why certain wars are begun, why Congress passes certain legislation, and why it is necessary for those people who are outside of government and for that class whose interests are not represented by the government to organize and mobilize around its own interests.
Kevin Phillips has a new book out, Criticism of the Current Situation in the United States, where he talks about the importance of theocracy, linking up with the political right. Mm. How does that weigh in your understanding of U.S. history, especially the current situation, the role of political right-wing politics linked to Christian theological movements?
Mm. Well, there's always been the idea of Phillips and the importance of this theocracy, there's no doubt that now at this point the U.S. administration is more connected with right-wing Christian fundamentalism than any previous administration. But it also should be recognized that religious fundamentalism and kind of religious missionary zeal has driven American foreign policy for a long time. I mean, when the United States invaded Mexico in 1846, and the phrase that was used was manifest destiny, and the man who coined the phrase, a journalist, said that the United States was following the dictates of providence, that is, of God. God was involved. Providence had decided the United States should expand. When President McKinley went to the Philippines, he said God told him to take the Philippines. Woodrow Wilson always it's invoked religion. Clinton did too. It's an old story. Despite the supposed separation of church and state, that presidents have always used sort of the sympathy of Americans for religion and the fact that, you know, so many Americans are religious. They've always tried to use that as a way of defending their actions and claiming that God and providence were behind their actions. So what Kevin Phillips is talking about is not new, but at the same time, I think it's been brought to a most extreme point by this administration. And that is, Bush actually talks about how God told him to do this and God told him to do that. That is very dangerous, because when God is behind what you're doing, you have carte blanche. You don't have to listen to the American people. You don't have to listen to Congress. You don't have to listen to anybody. You just have to listen to God, which means really you have to listen to the people around you, and you have to listen to the rich and powerful all claiming that they are carrying out God's will.
We're talking to Howard Zinn today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We've got a few very patient callers. I want to get back to the phone lines now. Line 4, Indiana, you're on the air with Howard Zinn.
Yeah, that carte blanche scares the daylights out of me. A lot of things that Mr. Zinn has just spoken in the last couple of minutes answered the question I was going to ask. So I'd just like to ask if he'd expand a little bit more on where this thing with Iran goes. I can see this religious thing around the horizon. The Christian right's already starting to talk about maltreatment of Christians. The thing that I guess, you know, is theoretically, I've been sort of trying to grasp how this government, the government works since the Grenada thing, and how things get orchestrated. Every once in a while, if something pops in and say, well, yeah, that fits. I just wondered, since you've been at this a lot longer than I have, and in fact, I read you to fill in some of the blanks, this orchestration thing that's going on now, is it at the level of understanding where one can predict what Bush and the boys will do next, or is it too ephemeral at this stage? Thanks.
Well, it's always difficult or sometimes impossible to predict, because you can never count on the good sense of the people in power, even from their own point of view. That is, you would think even from their own point of view they would recognize that the policies they are following are disastrous. You would have thought during the Vietnam War that even from the point of view of American power and American prestige, that they would have recognized early on that this was an absolutely disastrous war that we were engaged in and get out of it. But they didn't. They kept on and on and on. So you can't, therefore it's hard to predict, because they will not even act in their own self-interest. And they will plunge deeper and deeper into a situation that really does them no good, aside from doing the world no good. So I wouldn't predict what's going to happen in Iran. They're capable of anything. But I would also say I think it'd be a lot more difficult for them to go to war in Iran than it was for them to go to war in Iraq, because I think the lessons of Iraq are in the minds of the American people. What they're saying about Iran is what they said about Iraq. Remember, Condoleezza Rice talked about a mushroom cloud. They talked about nuclear weapons, trying to scare the hell out of the American people. And therefore, I mean, you can only sort of cry wolf once, right? And then people are onto it. And so my hope is that people will not fall for these hysterical arguments about Iran and the nuclear bomb, and that therefore the administration will find a public which simply will not go along with an aggressive war against Iran.
My name is Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580. Our guest today, Howard Zinn, the historian and political scientist, author of numerous books, including most famously A People's History of the United States. It's truly an honor to have Professor Zinn on the air with us. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Howard Zinn.
While Iran may be years away from building an explosive nuclear device, if they have enough fissionable material they can attach with a conventional bomb, they can have the so-called dirty bomb and kill hundreds of thousands of people. But my question is, if we rule out war against Iran, then how do we stop them from building nuclear devices, given the fact that they have sworn repetitively death to America and to wipe Israel off the map? And I will hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thank you. Howard?
Yeah, well, you know, small nations talk big. And, you know, this is true of Iran. This is true. This was true of Saddam Hussein, even though he had nothing really there behind it. And it's true of North Korea. You know, these small nations are not in a position to attack nations which are far, far stronger than them. Israel has hundreds of nuclear weapons. Iran is not about to attack Israel when Israel has hundreds of nuclear weapons. And as I pointed out, Iran is years away. And you ask, what could be done? Iran has offered to negotiate with the United States. They want to develop nuclear energy. And the United States government has been very resistant to talking with them to a diplomatic solution. These countries these small countries that develop nuclear weapons or that threaten to or plan to develop nuclear weapons doing it because they have nothing else, and they use them as bargaining chips to get something else, to get economic benefits that they can get from the wealthy countries of the world. This is true of North Korea. North Korea wanted quid pro quo, that they would not develop nuclear weapons if they would only get certain kinds of economic aid from the United States and other countries. Keep this in mind. So Iran may develop one nuclear weapon in 5 years or 10 years. The United States has 10,000 nuclear weapons. You talk about who is the greater danger to the world at this point, Iran or the United States? The leader of Iran, as hysterical as he might be, however, you know, his ridiculous some of his statements may be, who is greater danger to the world, him or George Bush? George Bush is, I would argue that George Bush is. I mean, it's the United States has signed the Anti-Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, which means that these nations who signed this treaty have said other nations should not develop nuclear weapons. That goes for Iran, too. But that treaty also says that if we want to get other nations not to develop nuclear weapons, we have to start, the nuclear powers have to start divesting themselves of their own weapons. If we have 10,000 nuclear weapons, we have to give an example to the world of divesting ourselves of nuclear weapons instead of holding on to 10,000 nuclear weapons and threatening Iran with war because they might, in a number of years, develop a nuclear weapon. It doesn't make sense.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Howard Zinn. Let's go back to the phone lines for our final caller. Line 2, Farina, you're on the air.
Hello. Let me see if I got this straight. About 3 weeks ago, Bush said he declassified the document, the State Department document that had Valerie Plame's name in it, and now we've got a CIA agent fired for leaking. I'd like you to comment about impeachment and about this reclassification of documents and how does that get changed. And one other thing, if we had a minute or two, if you could comment about the book or movie Catch-22. Okay, thank you.
I'm sorry. Comment on what?
Catch-22, the Joseph Heller book or the movie version of it.
I see. Well, since I only have about 2 more minutes, I'll just say that, you know, the whole business of classification, you know, the president does what he wants. He classifies, he declassifies. To talk about the president doing things legally, the president feels he is above the law, and it is, no law will contain him, and it's only up to the American people. And you mentioned the word impeachment. That is something we should talk about. Again and again, Bush has given us 100 reasons to impeach him, and just that Congress is, as I said, doesn't have the courage to raise the question of impeachment. except for a few congressmen who dared, like John Conyers of Michigan, who's dared to talk about that, and of course Russ Feingold. But just a word about Catch-22. I wish more and more people would read about Catch-22, because Catch-22 is about the absurdity of war, absolute absurdity of war, and how, as one point, Yossarian says, remember, it isn't that they are the enemy. They, the people on the other side. And the enemy is whoever wants to get you killed, whichever side they're on. In other words, it may be your own government that is your enemy, as well as the people on the other side, because they want to get you killed, too. Anyway, I wish more people would read Catch-22, and more people would read Slaughterhouse-5 of Kurt Vonnegut's book about the bombing of Dresden, there's a lot of good material out there to read.
Howard Zinn, we've only got about a minute left, and I just wanted to close if we could talk very quickly about the nature of race relations in the United States today. You came up, obviously you taught in the South, I believe at Spelman, during the era of the burgeoning civil rights movement. What is your sense of where we stand today with regard to race relations and the state of racism in the United States?
Well, you know, the race situation has expanded beyond African-American people now to Latino people and to the immigrant population, which is huge. And I think we ought to now think about anti-immigrant feeling as being tantamount to racism, anti-Hispanic feeling as being racist. And we need to build what Jesse Jackson called a rainbow coalition of people of color, who are now a huge number of people in the United States, and white people and people of color, against anti-immigration legislation, and more importantly, against an economic system which keeps a certain part of the population very poor and enables the people in power to turn white against black, white against Latino, white against immigrants, native-born against immigrants, something fundamental to deal with racism.
Howard Zinn, our guest today on Media Matters. Professor Zinn, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a privilege having you on the air with us.
Thank you, Bob.
My name's Bob McChesney. I want to thank my producer, Andrew Boyle, technical director, Brett Polson. We'll be back in 167 hours with our guest, Janine Jackson, from Fairness in Action Reporting. Until then, enjoy the lovely weather in the spring. Bye-bye.